Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Consilio Better Places podcast, where we explore the latest from planning, politics and development. In this episode, Account Director Luke Tatton sits down with Shravan Joshi, Chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee at the City of London Corporation, for a deep dive into the square mile's future. They cover the recent Common Council elections, the ambitions of City Plan 2040, and how sustainability, culture, and infrastructure will shape the years ahead. With insight into emerging policy, digital planning, and the next generation of talent and investment, we hope you do enjoy this episode of the Better Places podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Consilio's Better Places podcast. I'm Luke Tatton, an account director at Consilio, and today we have a fantastic guest, Shravan Joshi, Chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee at the City of London Corporation. With fresh election results, updates on the draft City Plan 2040, and major investment in fintech and offices, there's plenty to cover. So let's dive in. Shravan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks for having me on your podcast today, and a big warm welcome to all your listeners.
Fantastic. Let's start with something fresh in your memory, the City of London local elections. What are your thoughts on the newly elected Common Council and what it means for the future of the city?
Yeah, so we've just come out of local elections across the square mile. We have this very odd electoral base where we have businesses voting alongside residents in the square mile. And so workers of the city have a vote, have a say in who their elected representatives are. And so we had 11 of the 25 wards contested in this round of elections. And yeah, I think there's been quite a good turnover of members. We had a few retirees as well along the way, as you'd normally expect. But a nice new fresh body of councillors to induct into the corporation.
And I think there's 25% of new common councillors who were elected. How do you think this level of change will affect planning decisions? And how steep is the learning curve for new members joining the Planning and Transportation Committee?
So our Planning and Transportation Committee is what we call a ward committee. So of all the 25 wards, everyone puts forward members to join planning and transportation. The larger wards have two spaces, smaller wards have one. And so we have a committee of about 30 people. So yes, we will have a change in the makeup of the committee. We would expect it to roughly be proportionate to the turnover of councillors. So perhaps a 25% turnover across that. But you never know what that will look like. But I expect around that sort of change. And we always have an annual change in the makeup of planning and transport because it's an annually elected role from the wards. And so, yes, I'm looking forward to seeing what the new committee wants to achieve.
And speaking of new members, your tenure as chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee is coming to an end. Can you give us any insight on who might be stepping into the role next?
Yeah, so look, it is an elected position. I'm not going to suggest who might be leading or not in that race. But I think there are a couple of characteristics that we should be mindful of when we are looking at who leads on planning and transportation. I think if I look back at my tenure, I think sustainability and culture were probably the two major bits of work that probably caught most people's attention and which probably need further clarification and development going forward. So I think if we bear that in mind, that will help bring out the best people who have those kind of skills and experiences in their life to come forward as chair.
So a focus on sustainability and culture. Any other advice that you'd like to give your successor?
I think working with your neighbours is always good advice. Look, the square mile is not a bubble. We can't exist on our own. We need good transport infrastructure in and out of the square mile. You know, we always quote this number of 678,000 workers commuting in and out of the city. Well, those people live in the southeast of England. And so we need to have good, affordable transport from the inner city and from outer London into the square mile. And so it's really important that we bear that sort of infrastructure piece in mind. I think working with our neighbours, as I said, is really important, making sure that we are part of that ecosystem of the CAZ across London, that we are, you know, a material part of the London plan that's going to happen next year. And I think, you know, if you look at the growth plan that was announced just a few weeks ago by Howard Dorber and Sadiq, actually, to me, the city absolutely embodies that growth plan. And, you know, to me, the city plan that's going through now is a really good kind of binded document with that growth plan that I think will show our success in the future.
And with a newly shaped Common Council, let's talk about that long-term vision, the draft city plan of 2040, which will define the future of the square mile. For listeners who might not be familiar, can you explain what the City Plan 2040 is and why it matters?
Sure. So the City Plan 2040, as we call it, is effectively our local plan. It is our vision of what we want the built environment to deliver from now until 2040. That's the intent. And that covers several chapters. It covers chapters from tall buildings clusters through to heritage, through to culture, through to infrastructure, through to housing, a whole bunch of different chapters, pillars, I suppose, make up that local plan. What we've tried to do with this plan is be as skeletal as possible. So the idea is that the plan is a framework, and then off the back of that framework, we then hang specific policy SPDs and specific policy strategies that will come through between now and 2040. That's the intent. And I think the reason we did that was so that we can bring industry and development along with us, but that we're also able to respond to market forces. And so having that sort of framework local plan, I think, is the right way to go. It's a relatively short document, actually. If you look at most local plans, they're sort of used as door wedges. Actually, this one is quite a thin local plan in terms of the content, but the framework it sets out is very, very important.
So is having a broader but perhaps thinner framework something that makes this more distinct from previous city plans?
Yes, I think it does. And I think the way that we've focused in on specific pillars also sets us, you know, in a distinct way from what we've done in the past. I think it gives us a focus around the narrative to say, actually, if we're going to talk about heritage, this is what we want to protect. This is how we want to protect it. And this is how that interfaces with the other pillars of the plan that have equal weighting and importance. And so you create a wholesome document that still has frictions in it, but actually they're embedded into that framework.
Where are we in that process and what happens next?
Sure. So we actually went through a whole round of committee approvals within the city. So it was approved by Planning and Transportation last year. It was approved by Policy and Resources. It was then approved by the Court of Common Council. At that point, it becomes a public document that goes out to the inspectorate, to the Secretary of State, and they hold a series of examinations in public, EIPs. Those began last week. So we had our first round of EIPs last week. We've had two inspectors coming to Guildhall, and they will take soundings from interested stakeholders who can request to speak to the inspectors, and of course the city making its representations as well to defend the plan. That started last week. It's gone very well so far. I've got to say, I gave the opening statement to kick that off and really set out our pro-growth agenda and to say very, very clearly to the inspectorate that, you know, unashamedly, the city is pro-growth, it's pro-economic growth, and we have to deliver that not just for our own micro good, but actually for the good of London and for the good of UK PLC.
The city is often called the engine of London. I think that, like you say, in this plan, having the growth for that engine is a really important part of it. What excites you most about what the city plan can deliver for the square mile?
So to me, and you'll have seen as well, you'll have seen various images produced that create this sort of cluster. You know, the cluster is now matured and you've got a sort of a more wholesome body along the skyline that you can define as the city skyline. I think that would be something spectacular to see realised. Against that backdrop, you've then got, you know, the heritage assets like St Paul's that we really want to protect and make sure they're enlivened. And there's a whole lighting strategy actually that's going on with St Paul's that I think in the next few years we're going to see that monument just celebrated in such a different, fabulous way. I also expect the plan to deliver much more clarity and precision around the way we go around delivering cultural activations in the city. So to date, when you look at the way we've delivered opportunities for different groups of people to enjoy the square mile, it's been done very much by a developer-led solution, right? Or it's circumstantial. You know, we've discovered some Roman ruins and we're going to celebrate that. I think what we are developing now in the city is a cultural strategy framework as a separate piece of work. And I think that will start to feed into the way that the city fabric looks and feels from a cultural perspective.
How is that going to be different from previous cultural strategies? I'm thinking of things like Destination City, even though that might have a slightly wider remit, Culture Mile, which then evolved into a bid. So how are you envisioning this culture framework within the city plan to be distinct and develop?
Look, they all have to work together. I've probably got a couple of archive rooms full of strategies for the city corporation. They all have to work together. They all have to intertwine. So when we talk about Destination City, for example, to me, that is an overarching growth strategy for the square mile, right? And so any cultural activation we do, any cultural strategy we deliver has to work with Destination City hand in hand. Any sort of placemaking we do, any sort of retail ground floor activation that we do has to work hand in hand with Destination City. These things can't be done in isolation. And that's where I think the local plan, you know, go sort of closing that circle, the local plan kicks in because it provides that framework to say, look, all these bits have to work together if we're going to create a wholesome city.
And I think we've touched on it slightly before, but your tenure as chairman has also seen a really active period in policy development. We've had sustainability SPD, the lighting SPD, the whole life cycle carbon optioneering planning advice note, bit of a mouthful, as well as some more. Was this proactive approach something you deliberately set out to achieve, or did it evolve organically?
So I think I would love to say it was all part of the big plan and we knew exactly what we were doing on day one. And here you go. Here's the series of specific policies that have emerged from it. I think some of it is organic. If I go back to when I first joined planning in 2018, when I was elected into the corporation, everyone was talking about how to manage that carbon narrative against the backdrop of future development. And I think it was conversations like that with groups like the CPA, with stakeholders, with developers, with investors, and with politicians and officers that's organically grown into some of those sustainability SPDs. And I think we've done the right thing by doing it in an organic way, in a collaborative way, because you've then got pragmatic policies. I think the risk is if you start making these kinds of policy frameworks in isolation, or as, if I use the word in its cynical way, is it's too planned, actually you run the risk of it not being deliverable. And I think what we've done in having that sort of pragmatic policy piece around sustainability is it's been achievable, it's staged, so there is no desire to impinge on growth whilst we deliver sustainability, which is why we focused very much initially on operational carbon and said, look, we can quantify this, we can baseline it, and we can work from there to deliver operational net zero. We said, all right, that's now been acceptable by the market. Now let's tackle the harder bit, the embodied carbon. And if you look at the latest sustainability SPD that came out at the end of the year, which really tackled embodied carbon and how we measure that and the kind of discussions and debate that we want with officers at a very, very early stage of pre-planning to say, you've got to have your carbon optioneering laid out and well understood if you're going to go anywhere near a redevelopment of a scheme. And I think that sort of clarity and transparency is why I think these will be very successful policies.
And it sounds like with how the new city plan is shaping up, we're going to have a continuation of that organic approach with pragmatic policies that can pivot to where the market and policy needs to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was actually talking to the planning director earlier this week and I said, look, you know, whoever comes in next, whoever the next chair is, you will need to lay out for them what the sort of pipeline of policies is against the backdrop of the pipeline of schemes that are coming through and really match those up and make sure that, you know, the development market also understands what's coming through so they can preempt that and they can pre-plan for that and, you know, speak to their investor base and say, look, these changes are coming. Let's preempt that and work towards achieving the same goal.
And other than the city plan, are there any upcoming policy changes or announcements that we should be watching out for?
I think the cultural framework is due to come out this year. I think that is a really critical piece of work. I think that will tie in very nicely with the launch of the London Museum next year. I think it will tie in very nicely with, you know, as plans start to emerge around Smithfield. There's a lot of excitement around Smithfield and what's going to happen with that space. You know, you will start to see more and more activity around what people want to deliver in that quadrant of Smithfield. And I think having that cultural framework will help drive that narrative. And that's a really critical piece of work for us.
The city is continually evolving. And one area where that's especially visible is how people interact with its buildings and spaces, as you've just alluded to. The visitor numbers at Horizon 22 and the Lookout have been staggering, over 1 million visitors since 2023. Do you think we've reached peak public viewing spaces, or is there still room to climb?
Yeah, you know, I was always surprised, pleasantly surprised, at how many people have been up to those viewing galleries. And I know they also keep a proportion of tickets for walk-ins on the day. And, you know, as I look out the window now, I know this may come out later, but the sun's shining. I can imagine there's a queue outside those viewing galleries to get up to the top. I've been pleasantly surprised every time I've walked past those on Bishopsgate that the queues outside have been phenomenal. Have we reached peak? I've talked to officers about this a lot. And the principle is not to deliver viewing galleries per se. The principle is to deliver unique perspectives and vistas that are not achievable anywhere else. That is the intent. That's got to be the philosophy behind these viewing galleries. What you don't want is a series of repetitive viewing galleries that offer exactly the same vista of London or, you know, the southeast, and actually deliver very, very little unique perspective. So that's the basis on which we start. Now, it happens that we are in the process of delivering the Eastern Cluster. And so there are a whole bunch of new vistas offering themselves up at this time. And so, yes, we've seen a lot of viewing galleries being conditioned into schemes, but that is because of that unique perspective that they offer. Have we reached peak? We may well have, or we may well, very well do in the near future. I think there is a political feeling, and I've seen this in playing out in committee recently with schemes, where members are starting to understand and want better delivery of the ground floor plane. That peripheral enjoyment of your environment as you go through it, as you transit through it, as you walk past it, the crop of trees or the bushes or, you know, a bit of greenery, people sitting on the grass at lunchtime, you know, enjoying that sort of environment, I think, carries a lot more value, placemaking value, necessary than having viewing galleries at the top of buildings. And we're starting to get that balance through. And you'll see that with schemes that come through that offer really, really high quality ground floor spaces for the public to enjoy are starting to get a lot more traction.
And I think the city does have a USP in that sense as being one of the only CAS destinations that permits and encourages tall buildings. And so it can have that which complements those ground floor uses that you're talking about. And beyond physical spaces, the city is also shaped by investment and economic confidence. Recently, 2 Finsbury Avenue saw Europe's largest office transaction, a major vote of confidence in the city's office market. What does this signal about the resilience and attractiveness of the square mile?
So I think it speaks volumes to the approach we took after lockdown, when, you know, we all woke up to the reality that, you know, are city centres valid anymore? Do they have a place in society? I think that was the question we were asking ourselves when we woke up from lockdown. And the approach that we took with Destination City, spearheaded by the chairman of policy, I think really set the bar for what the city wanted to achieve. To say, actually, it does have a purpose, it does have a role, and we've got to define that role. And we've got to earn that commute. And we've got to drive employers back to the square mile. We've got to drive business back to the square mile. But you're going to drive talent. You want to drive the best talent to the square mile. And if you're going to drive the best talent, you've got to deliver the best ecosystem. And now I'm not just talking about comparing ourselves to other London boroughs or other cities in the UK. I'm talking about our peers and our competitors in other financial markets around the world. Because if I want true global talent, those people have a choice if they work in New York or Tokyo or Singapore or London. And I want them to choose London because of the ecosystem they're getting by being in the square mile. So having that sort of principle behind us, I think, gave the market confidence that we would deliver the type of places, the type of built environment, and the quality of offices that then embody the values they have. And we're starting to see that coming through. If you look at peak rents being achieved in the city, they are being achieved in those buildings that have sustainability at their heart, that have good embodied carbon structures, that have good operational matrices around them, that have lower servicing vehicles to run those buildings, that are very people-centric, that are welcoming, that are open, that have really good amenities in them. And those are the buildings that are achieving peak rent. So that is being that principle is now being seen as translated into economic benefit and economic growth from a developer and investor perspective.
And in terms of attracting global talent, what global talent is evolving and its nature is changing, less about suits and boots, perhaps, and more about hoodies and trainers. Do you think the city is getting the balance right in attracting both of those different types of global talent?
Yes, he says, as he sat here, a suit and a tie. Look, I commonly joked that you see more people in trainers and T-shirts in the city in the summer than you do wearing suits. And long may that last. I mean, I think actually having a different demographic of worker and industry coming to the square mile is a good thing. I've been very clear with my planning director and officers that actually we should be sector agnostic. Whilst the home of finance and the home of law and the home of insurance is the square mile, and there is no desire to drive them anywhere but the square mile, actually we should be welcoming and open to other sectors coming in. And if you look at the way tech has accelerated in the last 20 years, there's no other industry sector that comes anywhere near that sort of acceleration and growth. Look at the way AI is coming in now. It's going to lead to phenomenal change in the next 4 or 5 years. Change that you and I could not sit here and pontificate about because we know what it'll be, but we know it's going to happen. So for me, it is very much around future-proofing what that demographic will want in its place. What sort of infrastructure they'll want is really, really important as well. Do we have the bandwidth and utilities? Do we have the ability to deliver the water infrastructure, the power infrastructure, the, you know, all that capacity, the transport infrastructure needed to bring these people in and out for their businesses to succeed? And that's something we really need to think about as we go forward in the future.
And how do you see planning policy, but also, I guess, political rhetoric in supporting this shift and how and where people work?
So I think employers have two tools in their arsenal. They have the carrot and the stick, right? And a carrot is always better than a stick, in my view. And so actually being able to encourage your workforce back into the environment that they want to be in is much better than forcing them back against their will and then expecting them to be productive. So I think if we can work hand in hand with occupiers, with tenants, to say, what is it that your workforce want? And have that conversation and deliver on that, it's more important. And that's where things like BIDs come in. That sort of hyper-local understanding of how we can deliver placemaking in that specific quadrant, in that specific street, in that specific lane, that's where the BIDs come into play. And they have huge amounts of intelligence and resource to be able to reach out to that ground floor plan and say, look, what is it that you need to be a success? And then it's up to us as the city corporation to help deliver that sort of streetscape and that environment that will allow, you know, SMEs through to large corporates to succeed.
Do you see that there's more room in the city for more bits, or do you think the balance is about right where we are at the moment?
Yeah, so I mean, look, we've been on the bid journey. I don't want to give an exact timeline because I'm not sure. It's about 15 years, I think, 10, 15 years we've had bids, or at least the concept of bids coming into the square mile. We've got 5 right now. We've purposefully left the riverfront bid free. And the logic behind that was that the North Shore of the Thames is one that is largely neglected. It is difficult to navigate. It is it's congested. It isn't welcoming. And yet, if you look all the way from Blackfriars through to the Tower of London, actually, you've got an amazing potential to enliven that area. And so we've carefully left that riverfront out of the bit. There is now a riverside partnership that's formed, and there is the likelihood of a ballot for a bid in the next year or so for that area. And I think that's really important. That sort of riverfront enlivenment will help drive traffic from this great World Heritage Site that we have, the Tower of London, through to the city, and actually drive footfall. And again, different demographics, families, tourists, school children, into the square mile to enjoy that space. So I think it's only a positive thing.
Concluding with some reflections from your time as chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee, as you've stepped down as chairman, looking back, what's been your proudest achievement in the role?
God, that's a tough one. The way that the city works is there's very little opportunity for individuals to make huge amounts of change. And I think that's a good thing. You know, the way that we work through committee means there is generally a much more unified approach to change. And so, to my mind, actually, what this committee has achieved is I think they've taken huge leaps forward in pragmatic policies, I think world-beating policies on understanding sustainability. And to me, it's not a very sexy subject, but actually it's a really, really important piece of work that we've done. And it's a piece of work that is now getting traction much more widely in London, across the UK and internationally. We've had visitations from different cities coming to us and continuing to come to us to say, how do we deliver that sort of carbon sustainability narrative where we are? And so for me, that's one of the greatest achievements of this committee's term.
If you could change one thing about the way planning operates in the city, what would it be?
I think planning in the city actually operates relatively well. I think we have a really good balance of highly skilled professional officers and well-informed lay members. And I think that equilibrium means we tend to reach the right sort of results. We are going to see huge change. Look, I've seen the Planning and Infrastructure Bill. I've had a readout of that. The next few years is going to see a reduction in the size of our committee. You know, we have the biggest planning committee in the country for probably the smallest local authority in the country. I think we're 0.001% of the UK's land mass. So, you know, do we need 30 people deciding on planning applications? So we are going to see change. And I think for us to have an open mind and embrace that change and perhaps preempt some of that change is a good thing. We know there is going to be more in that bill around delegated authority to officers, around having a much more process-driven and transparent approach to planning. The City Corporation has actually won a government grant to develop a digital planning framework for the nation. And we're working together with five other authorities around the country to develop a unified digital planning framework. And the idea will be that gives applicants a uniformity and a transparency to the process. So you know that if you deliver your documents in this way, in this order, the outcome will be process-driven. And I think that's a huge step change. And so I think we are driving some of that thinking change for the UK.
There's some really exciting changes, like, say, coming down the line. Do you have a timeline for that digital planning framework?
I think the first phase of that actually it came out actually late last year. The new grant was awarded, I think it was early this year. But I think it'll be sort of autumn, I think, before there are some outputs. And then, of course, it will go to consultation. It will go through the usual process that you'd expect for something like this across the country to get buy-in before it gets enacted. But, you know, as a principle, I think it's a phenomenal piece of work for us to be leading on.
And finally, what's next for you after stepping down as chairman?
So I will stand for deputy chair. It's an elected role, but I will stand for it at committee on the 6th of May. I think it's important that there is some continuity in, especially a role like planning and transportation and infrastructure, where there are the time lag on the pipeline of projects coming through. means that even if things are decided upon today, they're only executed and realized over 3, 4, 5, 10 years. And so I think having a year as deputy chair is something I'd like to do to help support that continuity. I'll see what I do from there. I suppose I'll become a backbencher, you know. We'll see what other committees attract my attention.
Sure, an active role no matter what you do.
Yeah.
To wrap up, let's do a quick fire round, so short answers only. First question, Liverpool Street or Bank?
Oh, Liverpool Street for me. It's in my ward.
Barbican Centre or One New Change?
Barbican Centre. And actually, I think Barbican Centre is going to be really exciting with its regeneration. Got £190 odd million of our own money going into that. It's going to be exciting.
Leadenhall Market or Spitalfields Market?
Oh, Leadenhall, no doubt. Going there 7 days a week, seeing people, you know, from Harry Potterites right through to insurance brokers and everything in between, enjoying that space, I think is phenomenal.
It's always good for an after work drink as well. Redevelopment or refurbishment?
Actually, refurbishment. You may not expect me to say that, considering I've delivered some really tall towers in my time. But actually, I think the excitement is refurbishment, and the learning curve is that retrofit. There's so much to learn. I think that's the exciting bit for me.
And finally, historic alleyways or rooftop terraces?
I'm going to go for rooftop terraces.
Shravan, you've been a great guest. Thank you for your time and insights.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening to the latest edition of Consilio's Better Places podcast. If you didn't already know it, Consilio is the leading built environment communications agency, so make sure you subscribe to hear future episodes of the podcast and to make sure you hear about all things affecting the built environment in the UK. Thank you.